session number 11731, rule 2.
Mr. Palmer, reel 2.
The second section of the transmitting station was what they called the HA section, which is high angle, the big one being LA, low angle. Now, the purpose of the HA was that we could in fact engage surface targets in the LA, quickly switch and engage enemy aircraft with the HA, which was what my section was. And I had in my section five bandsmen and a seaman. Now, when the torpedo struck, the first thing that happened, of course, was the lights went out. But we'd rehearsed all this, and it wasn't long before we'd got a lighting system going by emergency lighting, no problem. What the next routine was to communicate with the bridge. That was my job. And of course the bandmaster's in the other. So I tried to endeavour to communicate with the bridge, couldn't make it, no reply. Of course, by that time you could hear all sorts of rumblings going on up above us, and you could smell the cordite fumes coming through the fan vents and things like that, and she was beginning to list. Now, I couldn't get communication with the bridge, so I called through to my gunner, the warrant gunner, the man in charge of the gun, the transmitting station, on another telephone line. And I said, "I've lost communication with the bridge, sir." And he said, "Right, come through into here and assemble in this transmitting station." Now, going from one compartment into the other, which went through a door, immediately you went into the large transmitting station, there was an escape hatch, one escape hatch. And you automatically stood by it. So my crew all stood by this hatch. And the gunner at that time was trying to work out his next move. Now, in various parts of the ship, and we knew that above us there was what they called a damage control party, which is a group of men who are what they do, damage control. They're supposed to rescue anybody who's trapped or anything like that. Well, the gunner said to the seaman who was in my crew, "Open the hatch, get in touch with the damage control party and tell them we're trapped." Well, he went up the hatch to this seaman and he couldn't open it, and that was a pretty terrible moment, because for months this hatch had not worked. We had endeavoured to get out of it before and it was faulty. The spring on the cleats had gone, and we had reported it to the gunnery officer and nobody had done anything about it. This came out in an inquiry later on. It was a pretty hefty young lad, this seaman was, and in the end he did get it open. And the gunner then, the warrant gunner, who was eventually decorated posthumously, put his hands on the transmitting station steadying bar, said, "Abandon transmitting station. Abandon." So we abandoned. By that time, the oil was, as soon as the seaman had able to get the hatch open, of course, the oil came down. Now, oil on steel is dreadful. You can't either hold it, stand on it, or anything, you see. So it was a bit of a scramble. Bandsman Lou Barber managed to get up. I got up. The seaman was by that time out trying to get help. And eventually I got out. Now, when I got out, you used a series of mess decks to get across, to get anywhere near the surface, you know, the top deck or the deck. And I remember going up the hatch, covered in oil by that time, and There was someone behind me. I spotted the damage control party, and I yelled at them to come over, which they did, and they pulled this other chap out. The last man to get out, he was. A man whose name is George Lloyd, who is now quite a well-known personality. He's now, to go ahead of the story a bit, he suffered a very severe shock, nervous breakdown and things, and was for several years incapable of doing almost anything, really. But he was nursed back to health, and he's since written some 9 symphonies. A remarkable recovery. Anyway, so there we were, 5 of us all covered in oil and vomiting and things like that. It was pretty dreadful. And the other chap's still down there. Now, and I'm sure you don't want to hear, but we eventually got the ship back at a very great personal risk. Got the ship back got the ship to its destination in Murmansk.
Can you give any details about how it was done?
Well, by a lot of luck and sheer hard work, by forming a chain between the bridge and the rear steering position and passing orders. That was one method. We had to get rid of most of the heavy stuff. I think we threw the Walrus aircraft over the side so that the ship wouldn't be top heavy and turn turtle, because we were listing very badly. Eventually we made there was one other thing. We had sent an SOS, a Mayday, to our accompanying destroyers, which were HMS Eclipse and HMS Fury, and we had told them that as we were now reasonably stable, we could manage the list and get the ship into Murmansk. They were sent off to go and chase the other German destroyers. And in fact, what actually happened was the Eclipse started firing at the Fury, I think, or the Fury at the Eclipse, and they damaged each other. But however, the enemy had gone, and the convoy was pretty safe. They hadn't sustained a lot of damage as a result of our business, although we had lost a few before. So it was all systems go for Murmansk, which we made. Now, when we got to Murmansk, we made representations to the Russian authorities there for steel, so that we could repair the hole in the side of the ship. But they hadn't got any steel. So I think we had to, in the end, to send to the Edinburgh, and they got some for us. And living in Murmansk at that time was pretty primitive. They'd got no food. Most of ours had been lost.
But you were living aboard ship?
Yes, we were attempting, well, as best we could. Yes. We couldn't live in the mess decks. You had to find a place where as best you could. But whilst we were there, the most dramatic side of it, so far as I'm concerned, is that it was decided that they put us in a dock, a very primitive thing, so that the water which was in the boat and the oil in the ship would drain out, so that they could get below and see what the extent of the damage was and all this and all that. And one of the things they had to do was to get down into the transmitting station and get the bodies out, which by that time, it must have been, I suppose, about 2 or 3 weeks, must have been in a pretty awful state. I was asked to identify the bodies. I didn't refuse, but I did express my displeasure at it, because it would have been very heartrending for me. Anyway, I think the Marshal at Arms, who is the man that is supposed to organise this, he eventually went down, and he found that one bandsman, in his attempt to get out, a man called Sullivan, he was our flute player, flute and piano, he lived in Tynmouth, had a wife and 4 children, very, very sad. he had actually got halfway out the hatch and the hatch closed on him, broke his back, which meant that all the remainder of the people down below were then absolutely and utterly trapped. And the casualties on there are actually the number of people who were trapped down there, and we never. And the first name on the casualty list is a man called Glass. And he wasn't a man, he was a boy. He was a boy bandsman. A band boy, in other words. Same as I was when I first went. That's terrible. He was probably about 16. Affectionately known as Curly Glass. Now that's about all I can tell you about the sinking of HMS Trinity. There were things going on that I was unaware of. Gold bullion was getting pushed around and that sort of thing.
Can you tell me more about your time at Murmansk and the conditions you had to live under?
Well, my memory is pretty grim. I can remember one thing quite distinctly. Of course, there were no toilets aboard the ship that could be used. And in the harbour, at Murmansk Harbour, there was a little sort of cliff to the edge of the inlet, the Kola Inlet, little cliff, about 8 foot high, I suppose. And this was a good idea, thought the ship's chippies and the Russians, to build toilets. And all they did, Mr. Wood, was they suspended timber out from the cliff edge out into the over the inlet, and they put one long piece of timber along the ends of these little struts. And if you wanted to go to toilet, what you had to do was to sit on the end of the of this plank of wood sort of thing, piece of timber. And you can imagine at about 20 degrees below zero what it was like. So everybody avoided going to the toilet. Food was nil. They did supply us with black bread. And if you've ever had black bread, don't. You'll know what it's like. It's dreadful stuff. It is black. The bread is black. It's a very coarse rye. And the inside is soggy. But we survived. Some of the chaps had to go to hospital, some of the casualties. They went down to a place called Paliana, where there was a very primitive hospital there. It was more like a Nissen hut with a fire in the middle.
Did you have much contact with the Russians themselves?
Not really, no. You were allowed ashore, but it was a risky business, because in those days they had a police force known as the Ogpu, and they were pretty. And what we had to do was to carry a little yellow ticket, and if you were challenged in the dockyard, if you pulled this yellow ticket out and showed it, you were okay. If you didn't, you got a hole in you. Actually, they didn't really welcome us, really. But it wasn't very long, a remarkable thing, that as the boats began to come in, the merchant ships and the aircraft began to go ashore to the local airports. Like there were some American ships bringing an aircraft known as the Brewster P-34, which was a very useful fighter aircraft, and they were flying off all over the place by Russian pilots, having been taught by American and RAF chaps. But really, they just didn't have anything there, Mr. Wood. There was just nothing there except snow. And another interesting thing is that at that time, Finland had come into the war, or it had been overrun by the Germans, and the Germans had bought heavy guns on the border. Now, if you look at the map, the old The old border of Finnmark and Finland is about 18 miles from the Kola Inlet, and Jerry wanted to bomb it, and he could. He could shell us at any time of the day or night, and that was another hazard we had, because there would be ships dotted around in the Kola Inlet, convoy ships, and waiting either to unload or go home or whatever. And of course they were constantly being shelled by these immense German guns that they'd put on the border. Another hazard.
Did any of the shells come anywhere near the Trinidad?
Not near the Trinidad, but they blew a sloop called the Sharpshooter up, and we didn't even get a mess stool or a survivor. They just blew it straight out.
What
direct
was it
hit.
Called?
The Sharpshooter. I think it was a Sharpshooter. It was a sloop. Which sloop being a sort of multi-service vessel. It can be used for mine taking, mine laying, can do any amount of things a sloop, or used to be able to. Yes, that blew that thing up in the harbour. Now the homecoming was a bit of a, when the Trinidad was actually sunk, happened something like this. The crew was split up. The band was incomplete. There was only four of us left, I think, or something like that. So we were useless. So they put us aboard the cruiser Liverpool to take the return journey. And they made us useful by a bit of guard duty and this, that and the other aboard the ship. So that's how I got home. Those that didn't go on the Liverpool or any other means stayed on the Trinidad, of course. She was sunk eventually on the way back by concentrated enemy aerial bombardments and packs of U-boats and things. And eventually the ship was so useless, it was wallowing in the water, ablaze from stem to stern. And the skipper, Captain Saunders, a man who we all admired, had a choice of two things. He could either stay there and fight it out, and as we'd got very few guns left, only a couple of Oerlikons, nothing to defend ourselves with, as you might say, he had the choice of either staying there or making a run for it. Now the trouble is, in making a run for it, the ship's speed would fan the flames and only spread the fire. So he did two things. He decided to run for it as long as he could. In the meantime, there was a convoy, I believe, the PQ-15 or something, coming in, making its way to Murmansk, which had three escorting destroyers. And he called them to come alongside and take off as many survivors as they could, which they did. What really the crew had to do was to run across the thwart ships, run across the deck, jump from the cruiser onto the destroyer, which is a pretty hazardous business with the quite heavy seas. And it was in the end decided, because she was absolutely crippled, that the best thing for her to do was to stick a tin fish in her, and I think it was a Matchless which sank her in the end, I think.
Do you know when you got back to Britain on the Liverpool?
Can't remember the date, but...
Or the month?
Yes. The action in the first instance with the German destroyers, when we were damaged initially, that was Palm Sunday, 1942.
That was the 29th of March?
Yes. You've got to add, I suppose, about a couple of weeks, 3 weeks or so before we eventually got back to the UK. And I got back to Scapa Flow. From there, I think there were about 350 survivors on Liverpool, something like that. We got back to Scapa Flow. We were put on the little ferry which runs between Scapa Flow and Thurso, a little thing called the St. Ninian. We clambered aboard that thing and went across to Scotland, where we caught a train to Plymouth.
What condition were you in when you got back to Britain?
Pretty awful. We all were, really. I think in the initial stages, when we were torpedoed in the first place, when we torpedoed ourselves, most of us, in getting up that escape ladder, swallowed an awful lot of seawater cum oil. And I can remember sitting with the other members of the band, propped up against the tiled wall in the bakery. And it was a Sunday, and that they had baked currant bread, which was a thing they did in the Navy on the Sunday. The bakers used to make currant bread for us. And I can remember sitting, all of us, stuffing ourselves with currant bread and vomiting all the time all over the place. So it was pretty awful. Apart from the fact that we were freezing cold, suffering from shock, all of us. It was a pretty horrendous experience down below there. And to me, I've been a little disappointed in the reaction that in particular the Admiralty then, what they didn't realise with all these bandsmen that are there. And yet they never received either the honours, the publicity, or the thanks. Not that you, as a serviceman, you don't expect thanks. But the amount of decorations is very few. My bandmaster, Davis, young fella, recently married. I mean, I think it was his first ship. And you know, I get very sad about the whole thing. We have a magazine called, this is just a coincidental information, we have a magazine of the Royal Marine Band Service called The Blue Band. It's a very good magazine, and I take it, a copy of it, every quarter. I'm a subscriber to it, and I take it every quarter. It gives you activities of the various bands, where they are. But of course, there are no ship's bands now, or very few. I think there's one on the Ark Royal, I think, or there was. But generally, the bands are now shore-based, commando units and things like that. And I don't know whether you've experienced the same thing, but on television in the south here, you may have seen them bombarding us with publicity about go to the Royal Marines Museum at Deal, at Eastney, Portsmouth. If you want a day out, go to the Royal Marine Museum. So I did. I have some friends in Portsmouth. He was a boy with me, and we served in ships together, the Crazed and the Furious and that sort of thing. And he took me one day to the Royal Marine Museum in Eastney. And there was an enormous amount of literature and activity information on the Royal Marines, which I'm very proud. Don't mistake me, I'm very proud of my regiment, the Royal Marines. But there was very little about the Royal Marine Band. I think there was a dirty old bashed out bass drum and a very old tatty uniform. Didn't say anything about the activities of the Royal Marine Band Service during the war. And I've written to the editor and expressed my displeasure. I've written to him twice. On the first occasion, he said that because most of the activities of the Blue Band magazine were voluntary, it was difficult to get volunteers to provide stuff for the museum. I can understand that. But I've written again and said that I hope that they would now do something about it, because it is now coming out, this, I don't know whether you know, but at the Royal Marine, at the Garrison Church in Deal, they had a memorial service, of which I have a videotape, in memory of those men who were killed by the IRA bomb. And in the church service, within the service itself, an officer, I don't know who he is, called the names out of the members of the band of HMS Trinidad who were killed. Furthermore, the music performed at that memorial service was written by George Lloyd, who was the man who was the last man out of the transmitting station, and who has written symphonies. And is part of his 11th symphony they used for the music. He also wrote a march called HMS Trinidad, which was performed, I believe, although I missed it, at the Remembrance Sunday parade this year.